We're in Port Angeles. I'm with Matt Walker, and we just got a tour of his two Rocket Mass heaters, and then we were talking about his livestock guardian dogs, one of whom he says, I'm not sure if that's a livestock guardian dog. So I spent some time with Greg Houghton, who about a year ago, and I lost all the footage and everything, but he raises these Northwest Farm Terriers, which he says are the new livestock guardian dog. They do everything a Great Pyrenees does, but with one-third the feed bill. A little easier on the wallet to have around. And he told some awesome stories. Maybe I'll get to those in a little bit. But for now, and granted, we'll talk about the Rocket Mass feeders in a little bit, but for now, we seem to be deep in conversation about livestock guardian dogs. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Paul. Welcome.
Thanks. It's a beautiful day here in Port Angeles.
Isn't it? It was awful all week. I'm really happy to see the sun.
Yeah, we got here just in the nick of time for the sunshine. I'm glad it was. I mean, it's been just awesome weather. We've seen I kind of expect it. I mean, we're so close to the whole rainforest. You kind of expect it to be raining.
Yeah, well, we got it all in this last week right before you got here, so.
Okay, all right. So it'll be interesting to see the whole rainforest when it's not raining. It'll seem like a lie.
Enjoy it. You're going to be one of the few people to see it that way, I guess.
So with livestock guardian dogs, you have a Great Pyrenees, which you were telling me is indeed doing all the livestock guardian dog things that you think a livestock guardian dog ought to be doing.
Absolutely. Yeah, she prefers kind of the company of the animals. She's here right next to us now, and she has the option of hanging out with the humans. She has a dog door in the house. But her choice is to go lay in the pasture with the cows or the sheep, or down in the barn with the chickens. And definitely at night, you know, dusk fall, she's sleeping right now because when it's nighttime, she spends all night barking along the perimeter. And, of course, I've had to shore up my fences because she'll, you know, go in maybe a two-mile radius if she's allowed to.
Right, she'll try to protect a much larger area.
Absolutely, yeah. That's her, you know, I guess her instinct is to pick a section of certain size and protect it.
Now, Greg Houghton was somewhere around here, and then you verified for me that where we are, you are familiar with the concept of predator pressure, and that Greg Houghton was telling me a year ago that the predator pressure here is extremely high, and we talked at length about that, and you were telling me earlier that yes, indeed, extremely high predator pressure.
Yeah, certainly. My property here backs up to what we have in Washington State as the Department of Natural Resources land, so state land behind me, forests, and then that runs right into National Forest and then right into the Olympic National Park. So for 100 miles to the south of us, there's nothing but forest. The mountains and all that. So, yeah, bobcats, cougars, bear, not that they're a predator, but certainly all those, and then smaller coyotes and foxes and all of that. I've always had, traditionally, a declining chicken population, and I have lost lambs to predators as well.
And then you got these livestock guardian dogs, and then how'd things go?
Well, honestly, I know we're talking about Northwest Farm Terriers, but the Pyrenees really is what made the difference. She, like I said, her instinct is just to protect the property. She wants to run the perimeter at night and bark at everything and sort of lay down her territory. And even if we were to go walk in the woods now, we'd see her trail. And I think that it does a pretty good job of announcing to predators that, you know,
beware.
Yeah, right.
And I will so take you on. And so the thing I've told people in the past is that a livestock guardian dog will take on a cougar to protect a chicken.
Yeah, and I believe that Pearl would do that. I don't think she would back down from anything.
And in fact, she would probably relish the idea of engaging the cougar.
Absolutely.
And use any cheap excuse to do so.
Yeah, you should see her out there when she gets fired up in the pasture. She is a sight to behold. Head up, tail up, you know, proud and running, you know, very aggressive. But it's the gentlest animal I've ever met in just day to day.
Sometimes when I pull up to a property and they got a Great Pyrenees, the owner says, stay in your car until we put the dog away. And here, she came up and she barked a couple of times and she was at my door. And I got out and she wanted to be pet.
Yeah, she has the most gentle soul of, like I said, of any animal I've ever run across. She is just a lover. I feel really fortunate.
Yeah,
a good dog. Now you've got the, because the other thing is the Northwest Farm Terrier, and you have one of those also.
And Greg Houghton was telling us about some stories about how he had several of them, and at one point in time, a coyote showed up. And then three of them went out after the coyote and out of his range of vision. And then a neighbor saw the coyote show up with the dogs right on top of it. And they actually literally ripped the coyote apart in her driveway. And no more coyote. So it does kind of, in the meantime, the story that we were told was that these Northwest Farm Terriers were good around the livestock, which was dominantly chickens at their house. So if nothing else, your Northwest Farm Terrier that you have, is it bothering your livestock?
No, certainly not. She's great as far as, being gentle with all the animals. But I do think that they're terriers. I guess I disagree slightly with Greg in that I don't really feel that the terriers are a livestock guardian dog per se. I think they play the role more of the farm dog, like a border collar, a companion and a herding partner and an alarm system. She's great with all that. But I don't think I'd leave her. I wouldn't try and leave her out there with the livestock like the Pyrenees is so comfortable being.
Right, because maybe part of it is that the Great Pyrenees is kind of making it clear that if you mess with these chickens, I will take you out.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, she definitely lays down the law and announces to everybody, don't mess with.
So the Great Pyrenees is the alpha dog between these two dogs.
Actually, no. No, not at all. The Northwest Farm Terrier runs her world. In terms of the relationship between the dogs, the Northwest Farm Terrier is alpha all the way.
Okay.
She's so aggressive.
But then if the Northwest Farm Terrier decided to eat a chicken?
I don't know how to answer that because I don't. It's
impossible to imagine it happening. Okay.
Right.
All right. I do think that they're going to be different, but I also think that you need to have at least two, and preferably three or more, livestock guardian dogs. And so you have two, but I do know that I've seen it firsthand where the coyotes will try to draw off the dogs, and then what will happen is one dog will go after the coyotes that are trying to draw them off, and then the other dog will stay behind saying, I know this trick.
Right.
And so I know that when I had Liza and Henry, from that song, There's a Hole in the Bucket,
oh, yeah.
Dear Liza. And so I had Liza and Henry. Liza was a Great Pyrenees, and Henry was a mutt of unknown origins. And so Liza was the alpha. And Henry was a bit of a chicken shit, and so Liza would run point, and Henry would stay back. But then I think what happened was is I think Liza taught Henry how to be a livestock guardian dog, and I think that's kind of how that ended up working. But I kind of wonder if there might be a little bit of that going on here.
Maybe, although the Northwest Farm Terrier, Rue dog, she is about a year and a half older than Pearl, the Pyrenees. So Pearl came into the game kind of looking up to Rue, as opposed to the other way around. Pearl has great livestock guardian dog instincts. Rue is a dog that you could teach anything to, but her instincts are really a terrier. She wants to go hunt rats in the barn, which is incredibly useful.
Big plus on most farms.
Yeah, so that's great.
Cuts back on the dog food bill.
Certainly, and that is really great, but again, Pearl just does the livestock guardian thing because it's in her blood. Rue does what Rue does because it's in her blood, but I don't know that either one has really, if anyone was going to learn something, it would be the Great Pyrenees learning probably bad habits from the farm terrier, and by bad I don't mean anything evil, I just mean, pestering you for pets or throw the ball she's a very people dog and like border collies or other farm dogs like that, she needs energy and attention and challenges.
One of the challenging predators in the Northwest, and we have them in Montana, but you have them 20 times more here, is eagles. American bald eagles. What a majestic animal. What an enormous, it's like a pterodactyl. They are enormous. And they will take a lamb. Chicken, that's like, that you need two or three to make breakfast, you know, and they're huge. And so, and I know right around here, this area is utterly infested with it. And then I know that you were just mentioning something. So when an eagle flies by, what happens here?
Yeah, absolutely. Pearl, the Great Pyrenees, that's one of her, you know, she hates birds of prey. She is absolutely alert to the skies, and she'll just run across the property barking her head off at them, head up, tail up, and she's marvelous that way.
And she will follow them around, and that's something that I saw our Great Pyrenees do too. It's like anything in the sky. It's like, I think one time we had a raven took a chick, and the moment that there was that sound, that ruckus, that the chickens were all making this, then she came up and she saw what was going on, and ever since then, she's always had an eye out to the skies for what's going on, and then anytime anything came flying by, she monitored it and barked at it the whole time. And like, just, I dare you, bring it, come on down here, let's have a go.
It's surprising, isn't it, Todd? I mean, I didn't expect that they would be aware, that, you know, the Pyrenees were going to be aware of birds way up in the sky. That surprised me the first time I saw that, but yeah, she's on it, like, does not want them here.
So I kind of have been thinking ever since I met Greg a year ago and saw his Northwest Farm Terriers, and he told me the many things that his Farm Terriers did. I've been kind of thinking that the optimal recipe for a farm of significant acreage would be to have one Great Pier and two Northwest Farm Terriers. And then because the Farm Terriers are smaller, plus they're going to go after some of the animals that the Great Pyrenees won't be bothered with. The Great Pyrenees, once in a while I saw my Great Pier hunting voles, but it seemed to be more like, this is a little something to pass the time. You know, not really serious about it, but a terrier is kind of like psychotic about it.
Absolutely, yeah. Roo Dog will stand out there in the pasture staring down at the molehills, I mean, for hours. And then, you know, if I finally instigate, you know, get them or something, she'll just dig and dig and dig, and she wants the rodents bad. And Pearl, the Pyrenees, no, she doesn't care at all about rodents.
Maybe if you want to dig a pond, all you got to do is, I saw it go down that hole. And then, you know, if you do that once a day for a few weeks, you might have yourself a pond.
I'll tell you what, she's got enough energy, you probably would.
I'm sure I saw it go down there. Just keep digging. All right. I think, is there anything else that we've missed in this?
Not really. No, I'll leave it at that, other than just saying that the Farm Terrier is just amazing, intelligent, alert dogs that need challenges. You definitely want to give them some stuff to do.
And can be taught, because a Great Pyrenees, you do not teach a Great Pyrenees anything.
Right, they're really polar opposites. And when you guys first showed up, I even told you about the way I deal with them and treat them. They're completely different. I think you're right. They make an excellent hair because of their differences. But absolutely, the Farm Terrier needs challenges, needs to be taught, needs some guidance, and loves, you know, she can do, I can't think of any more tricks to teach her. You know, she can do anything. She can get beers out of the fridge, and she can, she comes in the door, she closes the door behind her. I'm not kidding. She's just amazing. Whereas the Pyrenees, I couldn't tell her anything, because she just sort of does what she's going to do, and it's all pretty much good.
Yeah. She knows her job already. It is an instinct thing and doesn't really need any training. Just a little bit of, like, you know, these, like, you kind of pass on the idea, these chickens are with me, the pigs are with me, the goats are with me, the sheep are with me, the cows are with me.
Right.
They're part of our family. And that's all she really needs to know.
Absolutely.
And she's set. She knows the rest.
Yeah, right.
And it is, I do think, I kind of wonder if, like, it's always good to, maybe when you bring a puppy in, it might be good to have kids or people who really, really love dogs, and that helps to set their disposition early on to be good people dogs, because otherwise you get those places like the farms I go on to where it's like this psychotic dog comes out. Oh, and this is another good time to mention barking. I think that most of the times I hear people saying, I don't like Great Pyrenees because they bark so much. And it's like, every time I've heard of them saying that they bark so much, it's that they've got them penned in or they have them on a leash. And it's like, that's not how a Great Pyrenees functions. The Great Pyrenees has to do patrol.
Right.
And a Great Pyrenees, and if it's dark out, then they are at night going to, like, you know, send out the signal, I'm on patrol.
Yeah.
I am looking for bad guys.
Right.
Bring it. Just totally bring it.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, my take on it is, and I told you this already as well, is that Pearl, the Pyrenees, she barks pretty much all night, just like you said. She says to everything out there, I'm on patrol, you know, come on in, try me.
Yeah.
I find her barking incredibly comforting and peaceful. It's this sort of, really low, even though it's loud, it doesn't grate. The terrier, on the other hand, when she barks, you know it, and you want her to stop because she has that terrier.
Please don't ever make that sound again.
Yeah. So, you know, honestly, I've always felt like the terriers have the voice, and that people, if you were thinking about getting a dog and you were concerned about barking as an annoyance, the farm terriers might not be the dog for you. You might want to reconsider that. Whereas the Pyrenees, I agree with you. If you contain them, they're not going to be happy, and it's not the right situation for them. But if you let them do what they're going to do, their barking isn't a nuisance. It's a pleasure, and they're doing their job.
I remember at Greg's house, the terriers barked when we showed up, and I don't remember them barking after that.
Yeah, and Rue hasn't barked since you guys have been here much.
Yeah, she barked when we showed up.
Yeah, and barked maybe when you threw the ball.
Yeah.
A little bit. And that's it. You know, she barks like, with excitement. And so if there's people and they're getting all excited, you know, they'll use their voices to communicate.
They say, yay, this is awesome.
Yeah, this is awesome. Right. And you're like, I hate it when you say how awesome this is because that hurts my ears.
And then I remember my dog, Liza. The only time I ever heard her barking is like there's something out there in the dark and I have to tell them, I'm here. Right. Come get me. I'm totally willing to take you on.
Yeah, right.
But it seemed like it was like just three or four times through the night. We had some house guests that said, I can't sleep here anymore because there's that dog barking all night. And I kind of think, really? I didn't hear anything. You know?
I know that feeling.
But I kind of feel like at the same time, I've been to places where they do have a dog that barks in the middle of the night. And it's like, I'm the same way. I can't sleep here another night. That was just too insane. I don't, somehow, there's something about a certain, like you say, a certain kind of bark that's like comforting, like because when I heard Liza barking, I was thinking, go Liza.
Yeah, right. Well, honestly, you know, hopefully, the target audience here is someone who's interested in a livestock guardian dog or a farm dog, you know, but, you know, something to protect your flock or whatever it might be. And if that's the case, you're going to be pleased when you hear him barking, I would think. I mean, if you want a livestock guardian dog that doesn't bark, I guess maybe there's some out there, but it doesn't seem like it would be very effective.
So, yeah, I think that, you know, when it's dark out, I think that, I mean, basically, I know that Great Pyrenees are dominantly nocturnal.
Absolutely.
Because that's when most of the predators are at work.
Oh, yeah, she sleeps all day and barks all night.
She's sleeping right now. But I imagine that if the chickens made a squawky sound now.
She'd be up and at them, yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
She'd want to know what the hell is going on, and she's ready to take something on.
Right.
But I do, so I think it's a good combination. I think that there is going to be some barking, and that's part of farm life.
Absolutely.
I mean, here under such heavy predator pressure, would you be able to keep chickens?
No, I've always had a declining population until I got the Pyrenees.
So on the farm road I lived on before, nobody raised chickens except for us. And we were told that people had tried to raise chickens where we were, but that all the chickens got wiped out by one thing or another.
Yeah, absolutely. Even like I told you, you know, I would make chicken concentration camp coops, you know, that had guard towers and lights and razor wire, and nothing would keep them from getting eaten by predators. Now they're free ranging, and because the dogs are here, I haven't been losing them. I'm increasing my population.
So I kind of think that one of the things that Great Pyrenees might not be really good with that a Northwest Farm Terrier would be excellent with would be weasels.
Oh, right. Absolutely. Yeah. Pearl wouldn't care at all. She actually loves little cuddly things. She, you know, thinks they're her little buddies. Whereas Rue, the farm terrier, she wants to murder little tiny fuzzy things.
They're food on the hoof that it's right. Like... they need to be eaten immediately.
Absolutely, but you know, that same instinct, I think, makes them something you want to watch when you have baby lambs or other small babies. She's good with the baby chicks because she knows, and she does know the lambs are mine, but that instinct is strong to chase.
Eat.
Yeah, to eat, chase.
That's eating
things.
Size.
Yeah, right. It's a morsel.
That looks delicious.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, no, you're absolutely right. They're very different in those ways.
Right, right. And at the same time, I would think that, Pearl, so your Great Pyrenees,
right,
would probably say to Rue in a dog-like way, see that lamb over there? Mine.
Right, don't mess with it.
You touch it, I kill you.
Unfortunately, like I said, Rue is dominant. So,
okay.
So Pearl definitely defers to her.
Okay, all right.
Sounds like something getting killed right now.
Yeah. Those mices are like squeak toys when you chew on them.
It sounds like something.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cat.
All right. So, livestock guardian dogs, definitely, to me, it's the differentiation between somebody who lives in the country and somebody who's farming is the presence of livestock guardian dogs. And so most people, they're like, oh, how about deer? What's your experience with deer
here? There's definitely lots of deer here, and a lot of barks going on when the deers are close by, but as you know, I guess what I've read and what I've experienced to be true is that it's not that the dogs aren't trying to chase the deer, it's that the deer just don't really care after a while. So certainly if they're in the same pasture, the deer will run and jump over the fence where the dogs can't go, and then they'll just stand there and look at the dogs from the other side.
So do you have a garden here?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And do you have like that 8-foot-tall fence around it, or?
No, I don't really seem to have too much deer problems in the garden, and I think it's because we have so much other stuff for them to eat. I had a little bit of browsing on some leeks a few months ago, but minor. No, I really don't have too much of a deer problem.
I imagine that once the deer come anywhere near the garden, that both of the dogs have a powerful interest in those deer.
Absolutely, yeah. And the deer, you know, they'll just as soon go somewhere where they're not getting harassed is my take on it. I think there's better places to eat.
See, but again, I think that here, and this is something where I was talking to Forrest Schomer about over in Port Townsend, is that their deer pressure is massive. They just have massive deer pressure. So I imagine you are going to also have massive deer pressure. Well, actually, you might not have as much deer pressure because you got a lot of predators
right
in the area.
It's just like raccoons, you know, in my opinion. You have heavy raccoon pressure and heavy deer pressure in a little more urban areas where the population density is a little thicker because they don't have their natural predators in such numbers, so they can sit in your garden and eat it all, you know. But out here, where the population density is pretty thin, not many raccoons at all. I don't think I've ever seen one out here. And deer as well, you'll see them, but they're not likely to go looking in your garden for food. They're more likely to be in the woods.
Right, right. They probably see a lot of them in Port Townsend because in Port Townsend they're safe from predators.
Right, no cougars and houses everywhere and gardens with delicious trees, you know, fruit trees and whatever. So
yeah. A little safer there. All right. So not a lot of deer pressure here like there is in Port Townsend.
I guess, yeah, or maybe my specific situation. I guess that's my take on it. Yeah, that's not a problem for me.
All right. Let's talk about rocket mass heaters. And you have done a variety of things with rocket mass heaters that I have never seen before, and they are very impressive.
Thank you.
And so one of the things that you've done is that you have worked in glass so we can see the flammage as it's burning, which is just so awesome. I once bought a glass brick with the idea of doing it, but I never got around to implementing it. But you're using the glass that's intended for wood stoves.
Right. Yeah, wood stove door replacement glass. I've just been finding it on eBay. And it's pretty inexpensive. But it seems to be working great.
What's inexpensive to you?
Well, $20, $30 for a piece that's about 12x9. So I have talked to a glass shop that could be cut into smaller pieces.
Wow.
So I know the one that you've got. So you have a rocket mask here that you've designed for use outdoors, which has a few different innovations in it that I found really fascinating. And then you've got another rocket mask here that you've done indoors, which seems to be done rather traditionally. You've added a couple of interesting things to it. So let's talk about the one indoors first, and then we'll talk about the one outdoors. So the one indoors, you have a small window that is near the wood feed, but no air really goes by the glass.
Oh, no heated air, no fire air, none of the burnt combustion air goes by the glass. That's true. It does have a sort of a weak seal, so it does draw fresh air by the glass. But right, the window is situated about a foot, I guess I'd say, in front of the feed tube. In other words, all of the flame path is going away from the window. So it never has flame on it, and it never really has coals near it. So it's quite a bit cooler than some of the other ones I've done.
Okay. But it'll still warm up there.
Absolutely, yeah. One of the first experiments I did with that, I had a piece of metal where that glass is, and it was really neat to see how warm it gets there. And it's actually really nice to have a radiator down low like that, putting heat out low. So the glass does serve that function. It radiates heat down low, down by your shins or knees, into the room, and it shows the glow. I can be across the room, and I can glance at the stove, and I can see that the flame is still going, which is, you know, difficult with a regular rocket mass heater. You kind of see the top of the sticks poking out of the top and wonder what's going on down in the bottom.
So it seems like it's pretty small. It's like 5 or 6 inches square or so, the tunnel that goes from the window to where the wood enters?
Right. The tunnel is actually a 7-inch, I used a 7-inch piece of flue ducting to mold that tunnel. And you're correct, it's a tunnel off of the feed tube, and then the door, it terminates in that door, and the door is small. It's about, I'd say, yeah, 4 or 5 inches square, the door itself.
Okay. And then you told me that you put bread in there and you bake bread in your rocket mass heater and that where the little window is.
Yeah, that was a unintentional byproduct of that design. I placed the window far away from the flame, you know, for safety, or thinking it would last, you know, the window would hold up better. But in doing that, I made a chamber off of the feed tube that actually gets really hot. It has a perlite and fire clay insulated construction, so it holds the heat in there really well. And yeah, I started sticking little sourdough loaves in there, and you know, if the fire's really hot, you'll burn the top if you don't put foil over them, but if you manage it, it cooks bread wonderfully. It's great.
Great. And then this one also, above that little teeny tiny tunnel, you have what looks like a little bit of a cast iron plate right there.
It's actually an upside down cast iron pan, right? Like a frying pan just upside down in there. So, right, it ends up looking like a cast iron burner. And same thing, there's a bunch of heat gets pushed that direction, and that plate, when the fire is really hot, it's hot enough to hold something at a really gentle simmer, but regular use, it's really just like a warming plate, somewhere to put your coffee in the morning and it stays warm. What I found when I was experimenting with that design was that that location was too hot to sit on, which is kind of what you're sort of inclined to do. So by putting that there, I sort of just said, hey, this is a hot spot, and now I can make use of some of that heat.
Okay. All right. So now, from just, you know, conventional rocket mass heater stuff, you know, of course, the ongoing question to ask anybody who's put in a rocket mass heater is have you noticed that you're burning less wood?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's changed my life for sure, and I mean that sincerely. You and I have been talking for a little while now, and you found that I probably have a hard time putting my finger on a number, how much.
And I'm a numbers guy, and I know most people aren't.
Right.
But it is in a place where it used to be a conventional wood stove.
Yeah.
You took the conventional wood stove out, you put in your rocket mass.
Right. I think that maybe makes my situation a little interesting to folks, because I did heat the house solely with wood with a regular steel box stove, and I pulled that out and put in a rocket mass heater. And as we talked about earlier, I just converted my old woodshed into a greenhouse because I don't need it anymore. You know, I was was having to store so much wood for my box stove. I was looking around the property at trees that were going to be gone. You know, there's next year, there's the year after. I'm going to deforest this place in the next 3 years. Now I'm looking around going, gosh, I'd like to take that tree down, but I don't know what I'll do with it.
I think this is an important one. How much wood did you burn each year?
Yeah, like up to 10 cords, you know, definitely between 7 and 10 cords a year. This house is old, single pane windows, terrible insulation, pretty large space, and I was just burning through wood. And now, you know, I'm using materials that's from the waste stream, and there's a local manufacturer who supplies me with some scrap wood that I can burn in the rocket stove. I'm using coppiced maples, and I'm processing the wood with loppers instead of running a chainsaw. It's awesome. I mean, it is just a total game changer for me.
It's such a dramatic. I mean, before, it's like in order to get enough wood, you're going to have to chop down some trees.
Absolutely.
And you're going to have to move a lot of wood.
Right. Yeah, I've been talking with friends about it. We talk about now how we're making tiny model wood stacks, you know, like model wood piles. And you know, I feel like, you know, people talk about, oh, you had to split the wood so small or this and that. And, you know, certainly I do think that I'm probably going to handle as many pieces of wood as I did in that 10 cords, but they're infinitely
tiny,
smaller, right?
Wigs.
Yeah, so, like, the physical workload is so much less. You know, I'm not wrestling these huge trees and these huge rounds and then breaking them into smaller pieces and straining myself, you know, with thousands of pounds of wood. Now everything's just much smaller, and it's much friendlier on my body, on the property. I can use renewable, you know, these maples are gonna continue to make coppiced fuel at a rate faster than I can use.
So now it's kind of fiddly twiddly, whereas before it was an industrial job.
Right.
Now it's kind of like fiddly twiddly, just a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah, you know, I go wander around the yard with like the little wheelbarrow and pick up the sticks from the pasture. You know, what was a chore that you would use, and you would just burn those in a pile to get rid of them. Now I'm cleaning the pasture, and that stuff's fuel. It's awesome.
All right, now let's talk about your one outside, and it's like that's got like five different innovations on it.
Yeah, it's pretty progressive, and it's not like I thought all of this up. I was like, I'm going to build the craziest innovation, thing ever. It just sort of it's happened as a progression. I started with one sort of small thing with a couple innovations, and now I've just been using it like a test bed, adding on.
Before I forget, I want to talk about when you first started doing rocket mass heaters, were you awesome and genius like then?
No.
So now do you feel bad for Ernie?
No.
No?
Why?
Well, I just kind of feel like Ernie suffers greatly when newbies, like who haven't even read the book, ask questions, and Ernie just wants to rip their arms off.
Do I feel bad for Ernie because of
the kinds of questions that he confronts?
Oh, well, you know, I told you this already. I was so wrong about so many things before I built my rocket mass heater, and I think anyone that I talk to who's planning on building one, I don't get mad at them or upset with them or even point and laugh and say, no, you're wrong, you don't know. I just say, I was there too. You know, we were in a different paradigm, and I used to think of things in the framework of my old box stove, and just that's all I knew. And I understood, you know, how a rocket mass heater works, and I thought I got it. But until you've lived with one, you know, I had all kinds of inane questions in my own. You know, how am I going to make it burn longer? I'm going to put a giant tube on here and feed wood into it for 16 hours. Well, you know, like all those things that are just normal questions become moot points, and after you have one a while, you just go, that's a silly question, but I can see where they come from. So, no, I mean, I can see why Ernie's tired of it, but I also hope that he remembers where they come from, because I think it's very normal to have those questions. I know I did, and I was wrong about a ton of stuff.
I just kind of like the idea that the people listening to the podcast might be able to go out to the forums and help answer a lot of these questions that are that others know the answers to, so that way Ernie doesn't feel obligated to. Because when Ernie gets to a question and no one's answered it, then Ernie feels like he needs to answer. But then at the same time, he gets angry at people being so ignorant parent. I like the idea that we leave the tough stuff for Ernie, and then maybe others can step in and help fill in to free up some of Ernie's time, and that way we start really talking about the advanced stuff. Then I think, you know, we can move forward a lot faster. We can get a lot more of Ernie's attention on the advanced ideas.
Yeah, that seems prudent.
Seems reasonable.
Yes, very reasonable, Paul. Yeah.
All right, let's talk about your outdoor rocket mass heater. So one of the things is that the burn chamber has windows on three sides, which when you're all sitting around outside and you love to look at the fire, then you still got it going up your chimney. So you see the fire. Everybody gets to gaze upon the fire. And then the smoke is not anybody's eyes because it's going up the heat riser. And then it's cleaned up a lot. But why is it not entirely clean?
Oh, it's not entirely clean because you lose the insulation in what I call the combustion chamber, the burn tunnel and feed tube, by having the glass down there. You know, one thing that you didn't mention, which, if I may borrow your terminology, everyone sitting around is looking at the fire. They're also warm as toast. And they're warm as toast because that glass is throwing a ton of heat out. I mean, a ton. It is so warm it'll burn your shoes if you stand in front of it for too long. And all of that leads to, you know, a really nice experience. But certainly the stove doesn't burn as cleanly as a normal rocket stove because, you know, the burning, the fuel, I guess, can throw heat out away off through those windows.
That's cooling the fire.
Cooling the fire and not burning as efficiently. Right?
Yeah, it doesn't get hot enough in the heat riser to burn it completely.
Yeah, I exactly.
Yeah, and so it's a trade-off. You know, and the glass is definitely cool.
It's awesome, yeah.
And it's like, ooh. We're here in the middle of the day, but I'm just kind of looking at that thinking, this would be so cool at night.
At night, right. It is great. You know, you cook on it. It's designed. There's a hole in the top of the barrel. It's designed to be a cooker. So you get out there, and you throw the grill on top of it, and you cook up some burgers. And when that's all done, you sit around and gaze at the fire at night, and it's all glowy and warm.
And you can open the little window-y bits, and then you can put your marshmallows or hot dogs down there.
Sure, yeah, you can, or you could open the top feed and hold your marshmallows right over the flames there. You know, it's got a front feed through the door, through the glass door, and then a top feed as well. So,
and then you got like this piece of metal that can block the hole, because you've got it set up as a proper rocket mass heater, but you got a hole in the middle of the barrel, like right where the heat riser would shoot out the heat, and then you can see where the exhaust is coming up, but the exhaust is a little bit smoky, but that's because we didn't get that complete burn we were just talking about. And they got a chunk of metal there where you could slide it over the hole.
Yeah.
And then it'll do the and then you've got a bench next to it, but your bench is even different.
Yeah, the bench is a chamber. It's an idea from masonry heaters that they would call a bell. And I got to give credit where credit's due. Donkey Kirk made a post on his board where he took the two 90-degree fittings would have been at the end of a bench where there was a return in the flue path. He just made that a chamber. And then Peter Berg, who's Netherlands expert in the rocket stoves on his farm, you know, talked about how that was a masonry bell, and it got me thinking. And I just said, well, heck, I'm just going to get rid of the flue altogether in this bench. So in my bench, in my outdoor stove, I wanted quick response. I didn't want to heat up mass and have it warm for days. I wanted to sit there and in a few hours be able to feel your butt getting warm. So it's a hollow bench with about an inch and a half or 2 inches thick cob enclosing it. So I used sticks to sort of make a truss across a cob, open cob chamber, and cobbed over the top. And because the exhaust is lower than the inlet, you get an effect where the entire bench fills up with hot gas, and as that heated gas fills that bench, it fills from the top down. So the top of the bench feels that warmth on the inside, the top inside, and then that fills that bench until it gets down to the exhaust level, and then it can go out the exhaust flue.
Very cool. Very cool. And then you don't, it doesn't hold the heat for days, but it just holds the heat for hours, which is great if you're sitting around outside in the evening.
Yeah, that was the idea, was quick response. It doesn't need to have any lasting heat. The idea, like I said, is you cooked your burgers at dusk, and now it's, you know, evening's falling, and you're sitting around a smokeless fire with, you know, staring at the fire, and it's throwing heat off the barrel and throwing heat off the windows, and you're sitting on a nice warm bench.
Right. It's really brilliant. I like both of your rocket mass heaters. A lot of really good innovation there.
Thank you.
And you have posted pictures out to Permies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's videos on a couple of the threads on Permies and that show both of them.
I've seen the videos of the outdoor one. I guess I haven't seen the videos of the indoor one yet.
That was quite a while ago. Back in February I've only made one video of that one. I've been meaning to do an update. And you know, the outdoor one, actually, no one's seen what you've seen, Paul. I just did this day before. Yesterday, it only had two windows in it, and it did not have a front door in it. Now it has that third window, so, you know, maybe you'll get to
mighty
to
fancy
this.
Yeah, breaking news! Breaking news! Check out this new Rocket Man Theater with windows. Yes. All right. What else you got going on here that's of interest?
Oh, wow. I could go on and on and on, but my garden is really probably a thing that's been, that I think has some more innovations. I've been doing something that I did make a video on. It's very specific, I think, to my latitude, my location, but I'm tilting all my beds. They're Hugel beds, and they're all angled to the south. The garden is on a slight north-facing slope, and I've turned each bed into a tiny south-facing slope, so they garner a lot more heat. By stacking those together, they're protected from the wind, and I have stuff, you know, I've been harvesting food. It's not quite June, and I've been eating salads out of there for, you know, 6 weeks, 2 months. So it combines swale, catching the muck from my livestock in swales. I route the muck is above the garden. That runs into the swales, feeding the Hugel beds in these tilted, angled towards the sun beds. I'll have to show you. It's pretty neat.
Oh, we'll go take a look at that. And now, are they, how tall are they?
The tallest one is only there. I dug them with a shovel, so they're not not that tall. 4 feet, maybe, is the tallest.
Okay, four feet is the tallest. And when did you make them?
The first one where I was incorporating just my sloped concept. The first one I made in maybe February. There's videos of the construction. There's a stop motion video of a Hugel bed being built, and there's another video of the first tilted bed.
February of this year?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I guess I was kind of thinking, like, you know, if you get, like, I keep getting this idea of, like, instead of building a greenhouse, what about building a collection of south-facing sun scoops with Hugel culture beds?
Oh.
Some of which have really steep south-facing, like, a south-facing wall.
Oh, yeah.
That's maybe even totally vertical.
That's what I've done.
Versus some stuff that's, like, you know.
I've never heard anyone else even get this before. Cool.
I'm just thinking, like, instead of a greenhouse.
Yeah, so I, you know, in a sense, what you're talking about would totally work, and of course, it's going to be really site specific. I'm dealing with, this is probably one of the warmest days of the year. I'm dealing with very, very cool climate, 10 degrees on average, colder than Seattle. I'm at 49 degrees north, so low angle sun, very little of it because we have so much rain. It's blue sky today, but that's unusual. And then not only that, but I'm right on the Strait of Juan de Fuca, which is about a mile away, maybe two.
Isn't Canada right over there? I mean, I think we have there's a point where you have an opportunity to throw rocks at Canada if you want.
We do, every chance we can get.
And then I think they yell out, please stop throwing rocks.
Right.
They don't throw rocks back.
No, they're very polite.
They're polite. Yeah. Which is kind of funny. I really realize I'm a rude fucker when I do that.
Yeah, well, we all are, Paul. We're American.
You're American. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, Canada is about 14 miles away that way, right there. And yeah, it's cold. So my beds, you're right, you could do a lot of growing on the south-facing beds without a greenhouse. I think in my location, I still need a greenhouse. I mean, all this week, nighttime temps have been below 40. So,
it's
June almost.
So, I live in Montana.
I know.
It gets colder there.
I know.
Okay.
And warmer.
It's true. That's true.
Much warmer.
You're close to this ocean-y thing.
Yep, that's the thing. I have the moderating effect of the ocean. The ocean here is moderated by the Japanese current, so the ocean temperature is 52 degrees all year round. period.
Oh, my.
It's colder in the summer due to the northwest wind pattern setting up, and then you get the Coriolis effect spins the water near shore current going south. Coriolis effect spins the water offshore. You get upwellings, so the water is actually colder, high 40s in the summer. So our air temperature is cold. I mean, my average summer temps, I'm going to say, are rarely much above 60. Nighttime temps are almost always 50-ish, and that's hot. That's like warm weather time of year. So we don't get real cold either. I don't get much freezing, but I don't get much warm.
Right.
Like 45 degrees pretty much all the dang time.
Oh, because it's like, it feels like a good 70, 75 out here today.
Right now it's gorgeous. Like I said, this is like 1 of 10 days. Like, I'm not kidding. 1 of 10 days probably.
Okay, so this is a sweltering hot day.
It doesn't get any hotter.
Sure. Okay, all right, this is as hot as...
2 or 3 days of a heat, you know, a heat wave would be like 80 degrees, you know?
Okay.
All right. All right. So I think that's a wrap. I want to go and check out these gardens you're talking about. Do you got any, last chance, anything else?
Oh, man, I could go on and on and on. We talked about the coppice maples. We didn't talk about the way the sheep eat the cambium layer once I chop down those maples for firewood.
Oh, right.
The sheep peel the bark. They get a good little meal off of that, and then the maples are lying on the hillside with no bark, so they're drying for the rocket stove. So the sheep are facilitating the drying process and eating. We've got rotational grazing with the Dexter cows being followed by the sheep, being followed by the chickens. All kind. I could just go on and on and on all day long.
So I used to do a thing where go and pick some pathetic tree out of the forest for a Christmas tree every year,
mm-hmm.
and then when Christmas is over, I'd take that tree and throw it in with the goats. They'd nibble off all the bark.
Right.
And it would like they would do it perfectly and flawlessly, and then I'd let it dry, and then I would take it to I'd trim off all of the twiggy bits,
right,
down to about 3 inches. And so I'd leave these little 3-inch spikes sticking out, and then I'd run it through the bandsaw right down the middle.
Ah.
And then I'd have these two coat racks.
Sweet.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Like, it looks like I did this awesome work of, like, taking a draw knife to it or something. But
peeling it all.
But no, I didn't do any of that. The ghost did that. So easy. Instant coat rack.
Did you learn the hard way after they killed your fruit trees?
No. I've not had much trouble with that.
Like you.
Yeah, I usually put big fences around it. But now...
I'll be honest, I learned
bone
the hard
sauce.
Way.
Oh,
yeah.
You did? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, the bone sauce. Did that keep the goat? Will you think that will keep the goats off the trees?
I've not only the SEP, of course, swear by it, but I have now heard from 5 different people that once I put the video up, this is the great thing about the videos and the articles and everything, is that I've heard from 5 different people that have said, I did that last year. And it worked great.
Wow.
You know, so all the feedback I've got has been positive. I haven't heard from anybody that said it didn't work. Like, I went and I did, but of course, I imagine there's got to be a million ways to make the bone sauce not work. And I mean, it's a matter of observation. Well, let's see, these guys over here got it to work, and those people over there that seem really fucking stupid, they didn't get it to work. Huh. I wonder why they didn't get it to work.
Oh.
We made it, and then we looked at those trees, and they got all at. And now we got that stored in the house, and it sure does stink.
When I hear you talk that way, I'm always afraid that I'm one of the stupid ones, though, Paul. don't judge me.
I judge everybody.
I know.
Well, I judged the work that you did. I called it innovative.
I appreciate that.
And it was good. I thought it was good. I mean, I've seen a lot of innovation where it's like, that's stupid. You think it's innovative. I think you're going to burn your damn house down. And when it does, I will point and laugh.
Well, there's definitely some stuff you can point and laugh at here.
Oh, well, let's go look at it. Let's go look at it.
Okay.
All right, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about rocket mass heaters, livestock guardian dogs, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.